Words for Life today is by Cameron Grant of Confident Faith Australia. This is a talk he gave at Eastleigh Community Church recently. He addresses the question, is the New Testament true?
We're going to be looking at, is the New Testament true? But today we're just going to briefly cover 5 points that I want to just share and leave with you all as an effective and easy way to think about answering this question. And that is 5 E's of New Testament reliability. Basically 5 reasons, 5 lines of evidence, all starting with the letter E, that demonstrate that the New Testament is true. And they are, 1, early testimony. The New Testament was written early. It wasn't written hundreds of years after Jesus' life, like some claim. 2, eyewitness testimony. The New Testament truly was written by the eyewitnesses, by the disciples and apostles of Jesus in that first century. 3, embarrassing testimony. Embarrassing testimony. There's so many details in the New Testament that are embarrassing to the disciples and the apostles. And I'll share a little bit more about why that points us to it being true. 4, excruciating testimony. I want to talk a little bit about the lives, the transformed lives of the disciples following the resurrection of Jesus, and why them being martyred and never recanting their faith points us to the truth of the New Testament. And 5, extra-biblical testimony. Extra-biblical means, you know, testimony outside of the New Testament that supports its reliability, that supports its trustworthiness. So, 1, early testimony. You know, many people today, many skeptics will claim that the New Testament was written 100-plus years after the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. Therefore, you know, it's most reasonable to claim and to believe that it's unreliable, because if so much time had passed, you know, how have the events been remembered accurately? How have they been written down without some sort of mistake being made or embellishments being made? And so how then can we be confident in the New Testament if it's not written early? So I want to share three things that can point us to being confident that the New Testament was written early. That is the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, the life of the Apostle Paul, and the writings of Luke. So 1, the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. You know, it's a historical fact that the Roman Empire destroys Jerusalem in 70 AD. It's a devastating event for the Jewish people. I don't think us today could imagine how devastating it would be. It would be, I genuinely can't think of something that the sacking of the Jewish temple back in that time, back in that culture, I genuinely can't think of an equivalent today. Even if churches here in the West were destroyed today, I don't think it carries the same significance as the Jewish people in Bible times having their temple destroyed. It was just so significant. And what's interesting is that there's no mention of this event in the New Testament, which is strange considering how significant it is. And if the skeptic's contention is correct that it was written hundreds of years after Jesus and that it's all a cleverly concocted story, surely they would have included this in the Bible. Jesus predicted such an event, Matthew 24. So I think given that there's no mention of this in the Bible, it's most reasonable to conclude that the Bible, or the New Testament, sorry, was written prior to 70 AD, or a good portion of it before 70 AD. We're 40 years after Jesus and earlier and closer. Secondly, I want to talk about the life of Paul. You know, initially a Pharisee who persecuted Christians, but then had an encounter on the road to Damascus with the risen Jesus, totally transforms his life. He then becomes a Christian, goes on to write 70% of the New Testament. And it's a historical fact that Paul was martyred in Rome in the mid-60s AD. So I'm going to go out on a limb and suggest that most of his writings, all of his writings, were done before his death. And so 70% of the New Testament must have been written before his death in the mid-60s. Interestingly, the Apostle Paul quotes the Gospel of Luke in 1 Timothy chapter 5, 17 and 18. So the Gospel of Luke must have been even prior to Paul. maybe early 60s, late 50s at a conservative guess. And I also want to point out 1 Corinthians 15, verse 3 to 5. Paul quotes a list of witnesses to Jesus' resurrection. I'll just briefly read that passage for you. "For what I received, I passed on to you as of first importance, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures, and that he appeared to Peter and then to the 12. After that, he appeared to more than 500 of the brothers and sisters at the same time, most of whom are still living." I love that line. It's sort of like, they're still living. Go check this out. It's true. I'm not making this up. You can fact check what I'm claiming here about the resurrection, though some have fallen asleep. "Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles, and last of all, he also appeared to me." Now that portion of 1 Corinthians chapter 15, is so significant because scholars have discovered that a good portion of that passage is actually from an earlier creed that Paul would have received during his visit to Jerusalem just a few years after his conversion, which was just a few years after the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus. So here we have evidence from Paul that is from an even earlier creedal statement to just a few years after Jesus. That's incredibly early testimony. And if you know anything about sort of studying ancient texts and literature, having that sort of historical evidence so close to when it happened and when the original writings were, it's so, so significant and should be such an encouragement to us and such like, that was so obviously God preserving that information all throughout history so that, you know, the good news of Jesus Christ was never lost, will never be lost, so that all can hear it and come to, you know, faith in Jesus Christ. Okay, thirdly, in this early testimony sort of segment, the writings of Luke. You know, Luke was an associate of Paul as well as other disciples. He authored a two-volume set of New Testament books. The Gospel of Luke is number one. The Book of Acts, you know, as you read those two books, you quickly discover, because of the introductions on both of them, that Luke's the author of both of them, writing to Theophilus, his friend, and that, you know, book two is Acts, and book one, the earlier book, is his Gospel of Luke. And interestingly, in the Book of Acts, Luke doesn't mention Paul's death in the mid-60s. So like the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, I think it's fair to conclude that the Book of Acts must have been written before Paul's death in the mid-60s. And so Luke, part one, the Gospel of Luke, is therefore written prior to Acts. So it must be even earlier than that. So here we're into the 50s AD. And, you know, it's been established that the Gospel of Matthew and the Gospel of Mark were written even before Luke. So here we're getting into the 50s AD, just, you know, 20-odd years after the death and resurrection of Jesus. You know, so it just, when you look at the history and you study the historical evidence, it just doesn't make sense to contend that it was 100-plus years until the New Testament was written. And so it's just, it's not a good objection to faith in Jesus Christ based on, you know, the late dating of the New Testament. All right, number two, eyewitness testimony. So the skeptics will object and say, you know, the New Testament was written 100-plus years after the life and death and resurrection of Jesus. Therefore, it couldn't have been written by the disciples. They would have been long gone. They would have passed away. It can't be written by eyewitnesses. How then can we be confident that it was written by the eyewitnesses like it claims to be? And here I want to talk about internal evidence and external evidence. Now, internal evidence is anything within the text of the New Testament that we can read and discover and work out that supports that it's eyewitness testimony. Now, this is, we could go into a lot of detail as to the internal evidence in the New Testament which demonstrates that it's eyewitness testimony. So I'm going to briefly sort of just share a couple of points on this one. A really world-renowned, famous Roman historian, Colin Hermer, went through the Book of Acts, just chapters 13 to 28, so the second half of the book of Acts, went through it with a fine-tooth comb, and he discovered 84 details that he, in his professional opinion, could have only been eyewitness details, you know, records as to the name of leaders or rulers, places, different geographical locations. And so I am confident that the internal evidence points us towards, you know, the New Testament being eyewitness testimony. Another one is there's a world-renowned Christian New Testament scholar, Craig Blomberg, but he's done something similar with the Gospel of John. 59 eyewitness details in the Gospel of John. That is just such compelling evidence that, you know, it was written by the eyewitnesses and that they were being accurate and faithful in everything they did if they got the little details correct. So that's internal evidence. I want to talk a little bit more about external evidence. So external evidence would be anything outside of the Bible that we can investigate and discover which points to the truth that the New Testament is eyewitness testimony. And so for this, I want to focus on the students of the apostle, students of the disciple John, students of the apostle Paul, and students of the apostle Peter. You know, students of John, there was many, known and unknown, many more than what I'm going to quote here. But two in particular that I want to share on is Ignatius and Polycarp. Ignatius lived AD 35 to 117. He was the bishop of Antioch, wrote several letters to local churches and local different apostles, and he quotes the New Testament books many times. So here we've got a student of the disciple John writing, and we've got historical evidence proving that John wrote his gospel, that John was a disciple of Jesus. Secondly, Polycarp, you know, lived AD 69 to 155. Converted to Christianity by the apostles. This was reported by Irenaeus, another, you know, huge figure in the early church. And again, we've got writings of Polycarp quoting multiple gospels and multiple books from the New Testament. It's just, obviously I'm a bit of a nerd for this sort of stuff, but for me it's just so compelling that we've got this chain of, one of my favorite apologists, J. Warner Wallace, he calls it the chain of custody. You know, we've got all this historical evidence which links us from the writing of the New Testament through the early church to church councils, into the Middle Ages, up, you know, up through the centuries. And it's just, it's so compelling. And it's just all here. And, you know, so many people in the world, I mean, just obviously have no idea about this stuff and what a compelling historical case Christianity has for its truthfulness and its reliability. Students of Paul now. The two I want to focus on is Linus and Clement of Rome. Linus is mentioned in the Bible. He gets a mention in God's book. Identified by Paul, 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 21. Linus being a student of Paul is also recorded by Irenaeus, like I mentioned, a huge figure in the early church. Linus goes on to become the Pope or the Bishop of Rome, or, you know, Pope Linus. So again, compelling historical evidence as to the truth of the eyewitness testimony of the New Testament. And now Clement of Rome, you know, he's mentioned also in the Bible, Philippians 4, verse 3. He wrote several letters, again, to local churches at this time, most notably First Epistle of Clement to the Corinthians. Writes that in about AD 80 to 140. Again, he quotes seven New Testament books. Again, compelling evidence that the New Testament was written by eyewitnesses and that it is true and reliable. And thirdly, students of Peter. There was obviously probably a lot more, but I just want to focus on one, John Mark. You know, John Mark is the writer or the author or the scribe that wrote the Gospel of Mark. And there's a few figures from the early church, Papias, Irenaeus, and Clement of Alexandria, who record the fact that John Mark was the one who preserved Peter's eyewitness testimony in the Gospel of Mark. And John Mark goes on to establish the Church of Alexandria. So here we've got students of John, Irenaeus, Polycarp, students of Paul, Linus, Clement of Rome, students of Peter, John Mark, so much historical evidence which proves, which establishes that the New Testament was written by eyewitnesses, written by the people the Bible claims the New Testament was written by. And so, a little break at this point. Here, skeptics might accept and acknowledge, oh, okay, yep, the New Testament is written early and by eyewitnesses, but they might change tact and dispute it and say, well, they might still have been lying. They might still have been biased, either intentionally or unintentionally. How then can we be confident that everything they recorded actually occurred? Maybe they made some of it up. Maybe they remembered some of it incorrectly. How can we be confident the disciples weren't lying or biased? And so the next 2 points, embarrassing testimony and excruciating testimony, is sort of the reasons why we can look at the New Testament and say, no, they were not making this up. There's too many embarrassing details, and they lived totally transformed lives to the point of being martyred and never recanting. So, embarrassing testimony. So the criterion of embarrassment, basically, in critical analysis, if someone mentions something embarrassing and it doesn't benefit them in any way, it's pointing to the truth of what they've said. You know, you never intentionally lie to make yourself look bad. So when there's embarrassing details in a text, it points us towards that account being true and being reliable. So I want to quickly run through a few things that are embarrassing details in the New Testament, not to poke fun at Christianity, obviously, but to just demonstrate these guys were not making this stuff up. They were experiencing God coming to earth, entering into history, entering into humanity in the person of Jesus Christ, and witnessing miracles, witnessing, you know, Jesus' resurrection, knowing about his virgin birth. So much sort of what, you know, secular people today would say, just weird stuff, but they're saying, this is real, this is true, it really happened, we really experienced it. So as strange as it seems, we've got to record it, we've got to faithfully, you know, explain that this is what's happened. So number one, throughout the New Testament, the disciples are repeatedly depicted as dim-witted. Throughout the Gospels, the disciples are slow of understanding. Time and time again, the disciples fail to understand fully or in part Jesus' identity and mission. You know, time and time again, disciples fail to understand why Jesus came, why he had to die, why he had to be resurrected, and what it all means. You don't include that in the Bible unless it's true. If it's a group of people centuries later making it all up, you just don't include Jesus' followers and apparently the ones Jesus picked to send his message out to the world as not really getting it and not really understanding it. Secondly, Peter is called Satan by Jesus. That's embarrassing. Matthew chapter 16, Jesus explains to the disciples that he must be killed and raised to life. Peter, you know, obviously lacking the understanding that we have, thanks to 2,000 years of church history, takes Jesus aside and rebukes him, stating, "Never, Lord, this shall never happen to you." Jesus turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." That's embarrassing. If that didn't actually occur, why is that included in the New Testament? The New Testament includes it because it's true. It really happened. Disciples run away at the crucifixion, Mark chapter 14. The disciples succumb to cowardice and run away from the scene of Jesus' crucifixion out of fear. If this is a story written by men hundreds of years later, just based on my own thoughts and experience, I'm not going to write that the men were the cowards that ran away. We're going to say we're manly men. We stayed and we supported Jesus until, you know, the Roman guards came and stole us away. Again, an embarrassing detail that points to the truth of the New Testament. Another one, first witnesses at the tomb were women. Love this one. Luke 24. In first century Palestine, women had low status as citizens and legal witnesses. Their testimony was not considered on par with that of a man. If the empty tomb story were a lie or a product of, you know, legend or myth that had developed centuries after or centuries later, It surely would have stated men, not women, had discovered the empty tomb of Jesus. Yet all four Gospels state that women were the first witnesses. Another one, after resurrection, some still doubted. Matthew chapter 28. Jesus stands on the mountain with the disciples before his ascension and just before commanding them to go and make disciples of all nations. The account states, when they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. It's sort of a bit mind-boggling that, if you're witnessing the resurrected Jesus, how could some still doubt? It's a really embarrassing detail, but it's in there because it's true. Jesus called a glutton and a drunkard. Luke chapter 7, verse 34. Jesus recalls what others have said about him. The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and you say, here is a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. Again, another embarrassing detail. Jesus' feet wiped by, a formerly sinful woman. Luke chapter 7, again, verses 36 to 40. Jesus is having dinner at a Pharisee's house when a previously immoral woman, apparently broken and regretful for her sinful life that she's been living, comes to Jesus in worship, pouring perfume at his feet, perfume on his feet, and wiping them with her hair. Christian apologist Frank Turek, like I mentioned before, notes that this would have been a highly scandalous scene. Such actions by this woman could have easily been misunderstood as a sexual advance. And, indeed, the gospel account we read about the Pharisees' outrage at Jesus for not harshly dismissing the sinful woman proves it. Again, an embarrassing detail, but the disciples are witnessing all that Jesus is doing, and they're just recording it, everything that they're seeing. Jesus, coming to love the sinner and to save the sinner and to not forsake the sinner, but to be there for them and change them and bring them into life. All right, the second way that we can be confident the disciples weren't lying or biased is excruciating testimony. Here I want to focus on Peter, Paul, James, son of Zebedee, one of the disciples, and James, the half-brother of Jesus. There's a great book, Fox's Book of Martyrs, that details all the martyrs throughout Christian history, and they quote a lot more than just these four that I want to focus on. There's some debate about the other ones, so I just wanted to focus on these four because, it's virtually unanimous that these four were were martyred for their faith in Jesus Christ. So firstly, Peter, crucified in Rome between AD 64 and 67 during the reign of Emperor Nero. His martyrdom recorded by Clement of Rome, one of the students from before, 1 Clement chapter 5, and then also recorded by Ignatius, letter to the Sumerians, chapter 3. Peter was in a position, he was an eyewitness to all that Jesus did in his ministry, his death, his resurrection, and Peter lives a fully transformed life and continues in that life up until his martyrdom in the mid-60s. There's just no way that someone dies for a lie that they know is a lie, which secures no benefit for loved ones or friends that they leave behind. People today, like, we might die for a lie, but we don't necessarily know it's a lie. The disciples, Peter and Paul and the two Jameses, they were in a position to know whether the resurrection of Jesus was true or false. They knew it was true. They went to their deaths, never recanting, not one ever recanted. Powerful, powerful evidence that the resurrection actually occurred and that the New Testament is true. And secondly, Paul. Again, like I said earlier, he's initially a Pharisee who persecuted Christians. I think in the book of Acts, he's holding the garments of those that are stoning Stephen, an early follower of Jesus. But then he has an encounter with the risen Jesus and is totally transformed, becomes a Christian, not just any Christian, but becomes the leading missionary of the first century. Like I said earlier, it goes on to write 70% of the New Testament. Paul is beheaded in Rome between AD 64 and 67 during the reign of Emperor Nero. His martyrdom is not just church history myth tradition. It's recorded in Clement, Ignatius, Polycarp, Irenaeus, you know, all of these historical writings from the next generation of Christians and Jesus followers. James, son of Zebedee, killed in Judea, approximately 44 AD. His martyrdom recorded in the book of Acts, chapter 12, verses 1 to 3. Again, he was an eyewitness. He knew for sure whether Jesus was truly the Son of God, truly the Messiah or not, and he goes to his death holding fast to that faith, never recanting. And then a really interesting one for me is James, the brother of Jesus. As we sort of mentioned earlier in the embarrassing testimony, James is the skeptical half-brother of Jesus, but then has an encounter with the risen Jesus. Like that passage from 1 Corinthians 15 that the Apostle Paul wrote, the list of witnesses to the resurrection. James is one of them, and he had an encounter with the risen Jesus, and his life is totally transformed. He becomes the leader of the Jerusalem church, eventually stoned to death for his belief that Jesus is God. His martyrdom recorded by Josephus, who was not a Christian writer, he was a first century Jewish historian. Just powerful, powerful testimony as to the truth of the New Testament. And finally, extra-biblical testimony. If everything that happened in the New Testament, everything that's recorded, if it's true and actually happened, surely it impacted the world at the time, people, places, cultures. So there should be evidence outside of the Bible that corroborates the story. And we find plenty of evidence outside of the Bible which points to the Bible being true. Firstly, Josephus, who, like I just mentioned, Jewish historian, lived from AD 37 to AD 100, wrote a book called Antiquities of the Jews, in which he has several passages, not just one or two, but several passages where he shares details about Jesus and about, you know, Jesus followers, and he inadvertently corroborates the story of the New Testament. Christian apologist J. Warner Wallace notes that by the writings of Josephus, we can conclude that Jesus lived, was a wise and virtuous teacher who reportedly demonstrated wondrous power, was condemned and crucified under Pilate, had followers who reported he appeared to them after his death on the cross, and was believed to be the Messiah. Obviously, being a Jewish historian, he's not writing in the same fashion and for the same purpose as the New Testament writers, but here we see testimony outside of the Bible confirming details within the Bible. Another one, Thallus, Samaritan historian, lived roughly AD 5 to 60. He wrote an expansive three-volume account on the history of the Mediterranean area in the middle of the first century. He writes to deny a supernatural explanation for the darkness at the time of Jesus' crucifixion. But in doing so, he unknowingly corroborates the fact that there was darkness at the time of Jesus' crucifixion, which covered the land, just as recorded in the New Testament. This establishes, again, that the New Testament was true and accurate in its record of that event happening. And then also Tacitus, a senator and historian of the Roman Empire. He lived AD 56 to 117. He wrote a number of books, wrote the work Annals, covering the history of the Roman Empire from 14 to 70 AD. So right when Jesus was alive and ministering, right when he died and was resurrected, and, you know, the several decades after that when Paul was doing his missionary work. So it's a really pivotal time. Tacitus unknowingly corroborated several details regarding the life and death of Jesus, including that Jesus lived in Judea, was crucified under Pontius Pilate, and had followers in Rome who were persecuted for their faith in him. And then just a couple of other sources. You know, it's not just one or two. It's Greek physician Galen, Greek philosopher Celsus, Greek writer Phlegon, Syrian philosopher Maribar Serapion, Roman historian Suetonius, and also accounts in the Jewish Talmud. It's We have a ridiculous amount of riches of historical evidence that establishes the truth of Christianity. You know, there's, I think, the same amount, if not more so, written about Jesus in history than some of the Roman emperors, which is just, it's hard to fathom that Jesus, in his day and time, had a relatively minor impact on the world of his time compared to, say, someone like Alexander the Great. Yet we have so much historical evidence about him that have been preserved throughout the history of the world. And to me, that's just God's hand and fingerprints are all over that, because God is, through his providence, you know, ensuring that the Bible and all the evidence that someone would need, like someone like me who, you know, came back to faith in Christ through all this evidence and through, you know, the reasons that we have for holding that Christianity is true, that we would have all of this to share and to explain to the world. Words for